intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade, and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante and Zuategui.
The Italian capital, Rome, has hosted an event dubbed A Journey into Persian Cuisine, organized by the Iranian Institute of Culture in collaboration with the Italian National Hoteliers Association Federalberghi and the Betoia Hotel Group. The initiative aimed at presenting Iran's rich gastronomic heritage and diverse regional influences. Italy, like Iran, places utmost importance on culinary traditions.
Iranian food is one of the most important food systems in the world in diversity and health. And one of the most important our obligation is exchange these food systems and gastronomy between Italy and Iran.
Gastronomy embodies the culture of hospitality and acceptance. Everybody knows how culinary traditions are important for Italy. The same applies to Iran, where I have been kindly welcomed a few years ago.
This journey into Persian cuisine is an initiative aimed at promoting intercultural dialogue through the universal language of food. Participants say it offers them an experience that engages all the senses and opens a window onto an ancient civilization. From savory stews like Rome Sabzi and Reime Bademjoun to aromatic rice dishes such as Chelo Chebab Kubide, participants had the opportunity to discover a wide range of Iranian flavors, textures, and aromas.
The food that I like the most is the biryani labu. I love beetroot and yogurt mixed together. It tasted delicious.
The food we had today was excellent. I felt welcome and as if I was in my own home.
Now I have a crazy urge to visit Iran. Flavors were amazing. The food wasn't even too spicy. What I loved the most was the contrast of flavors in every bite.
It's called gastrodiplomacy, and it is a form of cultural diplomacy that uses food as a tool to stimulate intercultural dialogue and strengthen international relations. During the event, speakers all agreed, through the universal language of food, it is possible to better understand the other. Max Civili, Rome.
The Venezuelan embassy in Tehran marking more than a century of Bolivarian military aviation, a force that Caracas describes as revolutionary, people-centered, and central to defending the nation's independence. This year's celebration also commemorates the 33rd year since the November 1992 civic military uprising, an event that Venezuelans regard as a rebirth of their modern air force and a turning point in their political history.
We mark 105 years of our Bolivarian military aviation, and since President Chavez established our defense doctrine in 1999, we remain fully prepared to protect the country. As you know, since August, the United States has issued threats, and for more than 17 weeks, their warships have stayed deployed. President Maduro has ordered military drills, and at the same time, we face pressure on many fronts.
More than 30 military attachés from foreign embassies in Tehran attended the ceremony, an expression of solidarity amid ongoing external pressures on Venezuela. During the opening remarks, the Venezuelan ambassador addressed what he called continuous threats and coercive measures from the United States and attempts to undermine Venezuelan sovereignty under the pretext of fighting narco-trafficking.
We are fully prepared under the current circumstances. All our armed forces stand ready and follow the commander-in-chief, our president. All military commanders maintain unity and discipline, and the solidarity we see today in Venezuela is exemplary. We are prepared to defend our country and the peace of our republic.
Iranian officials at the event praise Venezuela's resilience and its alignment with Tehran's own stance of strategic independence.
I can say that Iran and Venezuela's relations are strategic because of the high-level officials of Iran, I mean the president of the Venezuela and our supreme leader. They have this very high-level will to have strategic relationships. It's because of our, our beliefs about the resistance and resilience of against the imperialists and arrogant people and arrogant governments.
For Caracas, the 105-year milestone is more than an anniversary. It is a message of continuity, resistance, and commitment to their national identity.
Iran and Venezuela may be oceans apart, but they are close in their shared fight against imperialism. And on this anniversary, Venezuela is also vowing to keep alive Simon Bolivar's legacy. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Tunisia made the headlines on Wednesday after President Qais Saied summoned the European Union's ambassador to lodge an official protest against what he called the failure to respect diplomatic rules. A statement from the presidency provided no details on the alleged breach in protocol by the European Union envoy, but referred to the use of practices outside diplomatic customs, a reference to his recent meeting with Nordin Tabubi, the leader of the North African country's main trade union. On Monday, Giuseppe Peroni, while meeting with Tabubi, commended the role of the Tunisian General Labor Union, UGTT, whose response called for the country's enhanced cooperation with the European Union. However, the revelation sparked a criticism, with the Tunisian authorities calling it an interference in internal affairs. We believe that the president's invitation to the European Union ambassador and his request to respect diplomatic rules and international agreement reflects a commitment to national sovereignty, a principle that was violated in the past 10 years. These comes as Tunisia faces a long political crisis with the reduced role of parties and organizations. That has also increased the state's sensitivity toward any external actions. Also, the UGTT was part of the 2050 National Dialogue Quartet and seen as an influential counterweight to Saied since he took the helm of power back in 2021, which the opposition described as a coup. The UGTT's ability to take on a larger political and union role depends on its strength and influence. Since 2011, it has been a key player in both politics and labor issues and an active partner in every government. President Saied has stressed that national sovereignty is a red line. Any political decision is in the hands of the government, and that relation with Europeans must be based on mutual respect without pressure. Many observers say Tunisia is open to cooperation with the European Union, but remains firm in protecting its political independence. However, the latest row amid internal tensions and the challenges, the future of relations between Tunis and Brussels remain uncertain.
The European Union has been Tunisia's largest trading partner and TLA for decades. The two remains at odds over a number of issues, including migration and human rights since Saied came to power. The summoning of the European Union ambassador over the alleged interference in domestic affairs could sour the relation even further. Iskandar Nawar, Tunisia.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Dagal Chanup, Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar, like the house raids against our association Daljanoub in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment and they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association, and also private books, for example a book from the 1980s in German language from Rassan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the kind of we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after the state, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years later, the court has announced its ruling on the legality of the ban.
The Constitutional Court has now ruled after 2 years that the ban on the demonstration was lawful. We will now appeal this decision to the European Court of Justice.
Legal experts say this harsh repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years increasingly undermines democratic rights throughout Europe.
Gerade auch das Strafrecht immer mehr zu
criminal law is increasingly becoming a system of thought crime. This means that people are being reported and convicted because they hold a particular political opinion that is deemed illegitimate by the authorities. And I consider this a very dangerous development.
The European Palestine Solidarity Movement has faced unprecedented repression and discrimination in the past 2 years. Germany and Hungary are among the most repressive states, but Austria is taking even one step further, equating opposition to the Gaza genocide with terrorism. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
Pro-justice demonstrators supporting Palestine Action's co-founder Huda Amouri taking the British government to court in the first ever judicial review of a proscribed group.
This is the culmination of a really concerted effort and a campaign over about 5 years to completely crush protest laws in this country, which means completely crush the fundamentals of democracy in this country.
Over 3 days, the High Court is examining whether the British Interior Ministry, known as the Home Office, followed lawful procedure when banning the group in July this year. Last month, the government tried but failed to block the case altogether.
I'm appalled at the fact that genocide, the crime of crimes, is being swept under the rug in favor of the British state's geopolitical and economic interests. And we're familiar with this. I mean, obviously, I'm coming from Germany, where we are the German, the, not we, the German government is the second largest weapons deliverer to Israel. And the British state also has, the British Empire has interests that they are looking to protect. They are threatened by Palestine Action and by nonviolent direct action.
The hearing follows nationwide civil disobedience. The outcome of this court battle will have consequences for thousands of campaigners like these arrested for holding up these signs. Before the ban, which was issued under terrorism legislation, Palestine Action had targeted the UK-based sites of Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer. They also sprayed red paint into the engines of two military planes they accused of refueling aircraft involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
The prescription has come on, you know, because of a lot of pressure from outside interests, the military-industrial complex, you know, political lobbyists, military lobbyists, you know, both internally to the UK and externally.
The activists who carried out those actions are held in remand. Six are now on an open-ended hunger strike.
It can't be denied that this is all part of the same fight and it's all inextricably linked together. If the deprescription appeal is successful, then it will prove to everybody that this is not a terrorist organization. And there's no justification to keep people held in prison without trial on terrorist charges.
In a dramatic last-minute twist, the judge adjudicating the case was replaced with a three-judge panel, including one that voted in favor of the UK sales of the F-35 parts to Israel, fueling accusations of a stitch-up among campaigners.
Beyond the legal arguments, the campaigners here say this case exposes something deeper, and that is the length to which the British government is prepared to go to protect the Israeli regime and its interests, even if that means stretching the law to silence those who challenge them. Saipur Rizab, London.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. A young person can stand against the might, power, and menacing threats of the pharaohs of our time when their heart is with God, and they are connected to God. Keep this up. This assembly of young people who are gathered here, several thousand young people, if all of you and the country's youth pay attention to this point, I believe we will achieve greater, better progress in our worldly affairs, in the management of our country, and in confronting our enemies. As for the 13th of Aban, the event that took place on the 13th of Aban and the seizure of the U.S. Embassy by students can be viewed from two perspectives. One, the perspective of history, and two, the perspective of identity. This is an event that happened, and what we want to do is to correctly understand and comprehend this event. From a historical perspective, there is no doubt that in our country's future, this day will be a day of honor and victory for the nation. There is no doubt about that. It's the day our youth dare to confront a power that the politicians of the world feared. Those youth showed courage. They weren't afraid. And they stormed that embassy based on a rationale for a certain reason and for a cause which I will explain. It's a day of honor. History, we have had days of victory and we have also had days of weakness and decline, both of which must be remembered. When I say our history, I don't mean a history of 1,000 or 2,000 years. From the time colonialism was created and colonialism and global arrogance became prevalent in the world, our country wasn't spared from their intrusions and various events unfolded. Some of these events were important. We were victorious, and they demonstrated the strength of the Iranian nation, while others were bitter events that I will now touch upon. We must keep the pleasant events in mind, repeat them, and preserve them in our national memory. And we must do the same with regard to bitter issues and events. When we recall the days of glory and the pleasant days, we gain self-confidence and feel a sense of power and capability. For example, let's consider the story of nullification of the colonial tobacco concession, which was a significant event in the country carried out by Mirza Shirazi. When we remember this event, we feel that we are capable. We realize that our nation has the ability to overcome a great power like the England of that era, which was the greatest and strongest of all the global powers.
IRIB English Radio. us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Reactions are pouring in after Israeli forces carried out a deadly incursion into a Damascus suburb, killing at least 13 people, including children. Syria's foreign ministry condemned the attack as a brutal massacre, saying Israeli forces resorted to indiscriminate shelling after failing to advance on the ground. The ministry held Israel fully responsible, warning that its continued attacks threaten regional stability. Palestinian resistance groups also condemned the strike, saying the incursion shows Israel poses a threat to the wider region. Qatar also denounced the attack as a blatant violation of Syrian sovereignty and international law. On Friday, Israeli forces raided the Syrian town of Beit Jinn before launching artillery and missile strikes, leaving multiple people dead. We'll be discussing the Israeli violations and much more on tonight's edition of Spotlight with our guests. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, who's with us from Ramallah. And we also have security and political analyst, Mr. Ali Risk, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr. Can you break down for us, please, what is happening in Syria as the Israelis are repeatedly and casually encroaching on another Arab country's territorial integrity?
Well, I believe that this is exactly what we have to understand, that Israel is going to do this again and again in all of the region, not only in Syria, but in Lebanon, and they are doing that also in Gaza in spite of the ceasefire. It's the idea that Israel wanted to put forward their own ideas about how they are going to treat or to deal with the area from the upper hand of the Israelis, and that they can do whatever they want at any time they want. What happened today when they went to arrest some people from the suburb of Damascus, they faced the people themselves. It's not the army, it's not the regime in Syria, it was the people of the village, because they can't accept the idea of the occupation and what the occupation is doing, since they are occupying this part of Syria. And they resist the Israeli force and causing them heavy casualties of three in critical conditions, and three were injured. And that was surprising for the Israelis. That's what matters. Now in Israel, they are discussing this issue, whether there was lack of information, whether that was a mistake, a tactical mistake. But they are really annoyed with that. And that's why they sent back the Air Force and the artillery to shell this village, causing more than 13 of murders in this village. The idea here that Israel wanted to say, to set a kind of a format for the region, that we can do whatever we want. And if we return back to what Netanyahu said about the peace, which now Lebanon is talking about, negotiations with Israel, and also in Syria, they are talking about negotiation with Israel. Netanyahu said, only with Israeli strong army we can impose the peace that we want. This kind of peace that he wanted, the peace that you have to comply directly to what the Israeli wanted, otherwise they will continue to bombard here and there and to have atrocities against these countries and these regions, unless you comply exactly with what the Israeli wanted. This is this kind of peace that they are thinking of. So I think that's for the whole region and for all the Arab and Islamic countries to understand that you can't deal with this kind of entity. This regime, a fascist regime, it's not going to make peace in the region. To the contrary, they wanted to control the whole area, and this is their aim, and it's quite obvious in all these incidents that is happening, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon or even in Syria now.
Okay, let's bring in Mr. Risk. from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ali Rizk, weigh in on the events for us, please. And also another matter that has become even more clear than before is that Israel can attack where and when it wants. Clear actions of an international pariah and rogue regime. However, there's no accountability for these actions. How worrying and dangerous is this level of impunity for the region?
Well, that's nothing new. Ever since October 7, the Israelis have begun to behave as if they have the right to do as they wish, as if they're above international law, under this pretext of what happened, again, on October 7. So this is kind of a new Israeli strategy, and they have full American backing up until now regarding that strategy. But I'm not sure how wise the Israelis are being when it comes to Syria, because you have the new Syrian figures in power led by Ahmad al-Shara. They've been extending a hand to Israel for quite some time. And that's being met only with more Israeli aggressions, more Israeli occupation, more Israeli escalation. So in my humble opinion, the Israelis are actually committing a fatal mistake. They have there's a neighboring country there which is offering to be their ally. And they're actually, if they continue to do this, they're transforming that potential ally into an enemy. So I don't believe that speaks very well to the Israeli strategic thinking. And I think it just goes to show that the Israelis are pursuing hegemony at all costs. And I think if you can even more accurately describe it as being irrational hegemonic policy, which won't be good for the Israelis in the long term. And this has contributed to the emergence of a resistance. It appears that a resistance against Israel is in the works in Syria. Incidentally, this incident took place after Netanyahu and some senior Israeli figures visited. They took actually a tour in Syrian territory. So I think it's important to link it to that there are many in Syria, notwithstanding the gestures which are being made by al-Shara and by his government, there are many in Syria who are on a completely different page and refuse to allow Israel to do as it wishes and to behave in this way in Syria. So again, I don't think that the general Israeli approach towards Syria is a very wise approach, and what happened in Beijing, I believe, is evidence of that.
Sure. Professor Nimr, on that issue, we've seen the reactions from the HTS-led government. Many have criticized it, actually, for being insufficient. There's Syrian human rights activists criticizing the HTS-led government in Damascus for its failure to stop the Israeli regime's crimes since day one. Why this silence and lackluster reactions to the Israelis' attacks and crimes that they've been carrying out against Syria since day one?
The first thing that the Syrians are not intending anyway to have a kind of a conflict with the Israeli. From day one, they were talking about, you know, that they are willing to have peace with Israel, and they are willing to be part of, you know, whatever is prepared for the region by the Americans. And they showed a kind of, you know, a full cooperation with Israel. But the Israeli are not doing that because they have their own conditions which Syria can't accept. This is one issue. The other issue, Syria unable to face Israel at this moment for many reasons. First of all, it's very new regime, around 1 year now. And at the same time, remember that after the collapse of the previous regime, immediately Israel destroyed around 85% of the capability of the Syrian army, whether it's in the tanks and airplanes and the artillery and all things. So now I don't think that Syria in a position to stand against Israel as we talk in a kind of a war or in a kind of an aggression against aggression, but they can do something else. To clear that they are going out of any kind of cooperation, and they can allow, and they will say that if you are occupying our country, so definitely likely there will be resistance. So try to at least do these kind of things in order to pressurize the Israeli, because on the other hand, they can't do anything else, nothing else. It's only the diplomatic kind of way in order to stop Israel. And that's why we have the foreign ministry statement today, which is condemning and holding Israel responsibility. So what? So what? This is not definitely not enough. And they should do something, especially with the Americans, that now they are, you know, having this kind of relationship with the American. This will affect the American interest in the region. I think that they should now understand that they should apply some pressure on the Americans. It's not only the Syrians. I'm talking about all the Arabs. Why they are, you know, not even thinking about that? That's exactly also the same situation in Lebanon. In Lebanon, the President Aoun, he just delivered the speech and he said that we are willing to negotiate with the Israeli and to start the negotiations to cease fire permanently and to take out the Israeli out of Lebanon, the withdrawal and disarmament of Hezbollah. The answer came 2 days later, immediately by the Israeli, by targeting Beirut and Har Tahrik in Beirut. That was an assassinating, you know, Tabtabai. This is quite obvious that this is the answer of Israel. They are not willing to negotiate with any Arab country unless they are totally comply with what the Israeli wanted and they are under the order of Israel. That's the kind of negotiation that the Israeli understand now. And this is what Netanyahu talked about is the new Middle East that he's looking for. These countries supposed to submit to the Israeli will.
Ali Risk, Syrians are also not happy with the violation of their sovereignty by the Israeli regime. Protests have been held across Syria following Friday prayers in condemnation of the latest Israeli crimes in the Damascus suburbs. Do you think that this will also lead to rising opposition across Syria to the HTS-led government for their attitude that they've shown towards the Israelis and for their lack of action as well?
I think it will, the more the Israelis continue with this escalation, I think that will put more pressure, more popular pressure on the Ashara regime. I think that this, in the end, it'll put pressure in terms of Ashara's efforts to try and reach. As I said before, he's been making gesture after gesture towards Israel, and that's been met only with more Israeli escalation, which exposes Ashara to be rather humiliated. So I think that the pressure is going to pile up, and this may lead Ashara to somewhat take a different kind of course, not being so conciliatory towards the Israelis, particularly when Ashara, before his previous name, Al-Julani, meaning the Golan Heights, he had spoken about liberating the Golan Heights, etc. He's taking a completely opposite approach. So I think it is bound, if it continues, if the Israeli escalation continues leading to more popular pressure on Ashara, I think it's bound to lead to some kind of change. And again, this brings me back. Israel is isolating itself in the region. But you have to remember, I think, at the same time, what Israel's objectives are. One of the main motivators for Israel's escalation in Syria is to prevent the strengthening of Turkey. Now, we all know that Ashara is very close to Turkey, and what the Israelis are saying now is that having Ashara strong in Syria means having strong Turkish influence, and Turkey is seen as a competitor for Israel in terms of regional domination, being a major regional heavyweight. So a lot of Netanyahu's calculations stem from that perspective. So the Israelis are turning potential friends into potential enemies, but it's part of a broader project to establish undisputed Israeli hegemony, whereby they want to eliminate any Iranian competition, any Turkish competition, to be the undisputed hegemon. Now, I think the guest mentioned the issue of the United States. This is where I believe that there might be differences between the U.S. and Israel. When it comes to fighting Iran, I think that the Israelis and the Americans are on the same page. But when it comes to countering Turkey, I don't think that the Israelis and Americans are on the same page. Israel wants to establish hegemony, complete hegemony, including by diminishing any Turkish role, any Turkish influence. But the United States considers Turkey to be a partner in the region. The problem is that, as I've argued many times, is that the Americans are more in sync with the Israeli policy, or in other words, the Israelis often succeed in dragging the U.S. in the way they want in terms of regional policy. Will they succeed again in doing this now in Syria? I think only time will tell after this incident.
Very well. Professor Nimrod, the Israeli Prime Minister is attacking Syria out of desperation for a political and military victory after repeated failures. Do you agree with that notion?
To a certain degree, yes, because now remember that Israel is approaching also the elections, and some part of the actions by the Israelis, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon or in Syria now, it's also part of the campaign for the next elections. He wanted to say that we are still involved in security, and now Israel, I am, as Netanyahu, the king, as his followers would like to call him, is the one who could deliver the security for Israel and the domination over the area, and to put down any potential danger on Israel by Arab countries. So this is the what Netanyahu is thinking of now, and especially that they are approaching the elections by next year, or you know, like few months, if you like. Because of that, this is one of the things that in the mind of Netanyahu. But there are also lots of criticism inside Israel today, especially after they woke up in what was going on, and even the opposition in Israel are talking about this operation as a part of, you know, kind of Netanyahu wanted to show off some kind of operations here and there in order to have more of supporters during the elections. So this is, you know, one of the things which is Netanyahu is focusing on. And I do agree with Ali totally that Israel is doing really very harm to themselves on the long run by bringing in more and more enemies. And especially now we are talking about the people, and that what was really very, you know, important for the Israelis, that it's not the army, it's not the regime, it was the people of the village of Beit Jan who started this kind of resistance against the Israelis. So if that's going to be repeated everywhere, so they are opening a new kind of a front for the Israelis, and the Israelis are now talking about, is that necessary in this moment to open a new front or not? So this is really put Israel in a very awkward situation.
Ali Rizk, there is this theory since day one when, as you phrased it, these new figures in Syria came to power, that the HTS has been tasked with the Balkanization of Syria. I want to get your thoughts on that viewpoint. And if that's the case, who benefits the most from this breakup of Syria?
I'm not sure about that theory, that HTS has been cast with the mission, or tasked, sorry, with the mission of dividing or fragmenting Syria. Remember, again, Ashara, his closest ally, arguably his closest ally, is Turkey. Turkey doesn't want the Balkanization of Syria. That would give the Kurds semi-independence. That's the last thing Turkey wants. So I would be a bit hesitant to buy into this argument that somehow HTS has come in order to Balkanize Syria. I do think that Israel wants that. That would serve Israel very well to have an Alawite, then a Sunni, then a Kurdish statelet, particularly when the Israelis are talking about having a Jewish state. Ultimately, what the Israelis want, in my humble opinion, in Syria, is for there to be a failed state. And they want the same thing in Lebanon, by the way. They want it in all surrounding countries. Because when you have a failed state, that's the perfect pretext to further expand territorially. Under the pretext that failed states pose a threat because of the chaos, so then we must expand our borders. That, I think, is the Israeli strategy. And again, this strategy collides with the strategies of other players who are American allies. Again, I refer to Turkey. So no, I don't think that somehow Ashara has been tasked by those who support him to balkanize Syria, Turkey and others, but I do think that that is the Israeli goal.
Professor Nim, how has the silence of Arab and Islamic nations emboldened Israel to press ahead with its illegal actions in Syria? You addressed that a little earlier. I want you to elaborate on that for us as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Arab and Islamic countries, they do have the power not to pressurize Israel directly, but to pressurize the Americans. The Americans got their approval in whatever they are doing in the area, and they are, you know, very happy with that. And especially when they, Trump put his forward his 20 points plan for Gaza to cease fire, that was approved by Arab and Islamic countries. They also affected even the United Nations resolution on the same way when Russia and China have another suggestion, but the Arab and Islamic countries, they said that we are agreeing to that, so why you are objecting? So it's obvious that they have the ability to pressurize the Americans. Americans do know that they have interest in the region, and especially Arab countries of the Gulf states. The Americans knows that their interest there should not be contradicted with what Israel wanted if it, that come to the end of it. So I think they have the power to pressurize the Americans if they wanted to do so. The question is, are they willing to do so or not? I don't think that they are willing to do it, and they not much interested on one hand. On the other hand, most of them are complying with what the Israeli wanted in this respect. So because of that, they are not, you know, playing any role to prevent Israel of doing what they are doing in the region. For God's sake, you know, they bombarded even Qatar, which is, you know, considered one of the biggest allies to the Americans and the biggest base for the Americans in the region. And still they got away with it. So the Arab and Islamic countries are not doing any role in order to prevent Israel of doing that, though they have the ability to do it, but they don't have the will to do it.
Ali Risco, final question to you. Many countries and groups have weighed in with their condemnations, but the likes of the U.S. and EU have not with regards to this recent attack on the village of Beit Jinn. How do you view the inconsistency from these Western capitals and also the silence of their mainstream media outlets regarding Israeli actions in Syria? I'm not even sure if we can call it inconsistency anymore, because in these matters, they seem to be consistently inconsistent.
Well, I'm quite sure that the West, Europe, and the United States are basically bought into this argument, which the Israelis are saying that this was an anti-terrorist operation. According to Israeli media, the operation was to arrest three members of Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya. And after that arrest took place, then they opened fire, that group. Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya is a Lebanese-based group, by the way. It's the Lebanese affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what's interesting here is that just a few days ago, the Trump administration designated certain branches of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorist organizations. If I'm not mistaken, Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya is one of them, which was designated as a terrorist organization. So the West is going to see this, I think, through the lens, or portray it through the lens of an anti-terrorist operation, more than being any kind of violation of sovereignty or any kind of aggression against another country. Despite the fact, and this is important, despite the fact that the Americans have invested quite a lot in Ashara. I mean, Trump welcomed him to the White House. It wasn't the usual meeting. He was forced to go through a side door. But nevertheless, that was a big investment, especially when someone who used to be with Al-Qaeda, maybe he still is, I don't know, and Al-Qaeda was responsible for September 11. So the U.S. was willing to put all that aside and welcome Ashara. Of course, the main aim for them, for the Trump administration, is because Al-Shara up until now was anti-Iran, and anything anti-Iran for the Trump administration is considered to be a blessing or something positive. So that's the approach which the West takes. Again, which is not necessarily consistent with American interests. I don't think it's in American interests to have a Sharia weaken, which would weaken Turkey and influence badly the partnership between Turkey and the US. The US, if it wants to preserve interest in this region, it can't be only supporting Israel whilst being the enemy of all the rest of the Arab countries. It's true what your guest said, that Arab countries haven't spoken up, but I think in the end they will be forced to speak up. And the question remains, is America willing to sacrifice all of its interests for the sake of the most fascist Israeli government? That remains to be seen.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. Also thanks to security and political analyst Ali Rizk, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And, of course, a special thanks to you all for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.